My goodness, a busy day. You come back live after a trip up to Fort Wayne and then a day off to rest and, in my case, to vote. That's just about all I did yesterday. Got out of bed late and managed to get over and pick up the kids' homework and vote. That was it. That's called a day off at the Wilkin House. And watch the election results as they came in last night, such as they were. They always extend into the next day nowadays because, for some reason, it takes longer to count everything up. We're going to be talking about much of what happened yesterday and the results today and in the days to come here on this Wednesday, Issues Etc., coming to you live the 8th of November. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the first half hour, Bob Morrison will join us from the Family Research Council to talk about gay marriage and abortion initiatives that were part of the voters' mindset yesterday as they went to the polls. Kristen Day of Democrats for Life will join us to talk about pro-life Democrats in yesterday's election. Dr. Jeff Walls joins us. He'll just give us the big picture. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. And then later in the program, Congressman John Shimkus will give us his election analysis. He's from the 19th Congressional District of Illinois, and he won re-election yesterday. And then Serge Trifkovic will be our guest. Oh, running into the end of the second hour, we'll be talking to him about the impact of yesterday's election on the war in Iraq. It certainly was a factor in voters' minds, but what will be the reverse? What will be the effect of the election on the war? We know how the war affected the election. And then open lines for your questions and your comments on yesterday's election to round off today's Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Our first guest, as we hit the ground running, Bob Morrison is Director of Academic Affairs for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Bob, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be with you.
What's the post-election scuttlebutt in D.C., if you could put it in a nutshell for us?
Stunned. It's a stunning development, obviously. We've had 12 years of Republican control ever since the 1994 events, and this is it's a huge change. It's a huge shift. We at Family Research Council, of course, are not a partisan group, so we are primarily looking at the impact on issues that we're tracking. And we, of course, were deeply disappointed in the Missouri result on cloning vote. We know, I imagine you've discussed that at length, but how much was spent, the vast amount of money that was spent in Missouri to produce that result, that's deeply disturbing. And we can only thank and bless everyone who works so hard to come so close out there. And we think that's very, very important. You know, one thing we haven't given up on Missouri in that respect. California citizens are finding out that the promised benefits from their embryonic stem cell initiative of several years ago are far in the distance, but the costs are very, very present. So it's still possible that citizens, as they see this thing pan out and they do not get the promised cures, it may very well be that there might be an opportunity to reconsider whether this is a wise way to go.
Bob, you mentioned the 12 years of Republican-controlled Congress and then a White House that was occupied for the six of those last years by a Republican. And many people are asking, on issues like abortion or euthanasia, gay marriage, what has 12 years of Republican leadership given us? Your response.
Well, it's a very good point. For one thing, on the defense of marriage, we have not been able to get, as you know, we have not been able to get a marriage protection amendment passed through the Congress by two-thirds votes in both houses. But we have nonetheless had strong support, nonetheless a very strong support for the idea that marriage is between a man and a woman. And one of the things that I think many citizens will see now, many Americans will see, is that it's very unlikely that they will even bring a vote on such a thing to the floor as long as the current majority is in power, that they are, you know, they're not the leadership there. Speaker designate Pelosi, Majority Leader designate Reid are not friendly to the idea of amending the Constitution to defend marriage, to protect marriage. So that's something that citizens will be able to assess. I certainly say it doesn't help, and we're very unhappy when you hear somebody like former Majority Leader Dick Armey disparage dismiss marriage in the way that he did. He referred publicly to marriage as he was talking about the Congress, his own disappointments with the Congress, and how the Congress of his own party had voted on such matters as banning horse meat and attempts to defend marriage, and he put them in the same sentence as if it was nothing more significant or important. He was completely denigrating the value and the vital importance. To have had such a, in our view, such a limited perspective on the core institution of society shows part of the problem that we've been dealing with for a number of years. When you have key leaders like Dick Armey who so failed to comprehend how vitally important marriage is for any healthy and stable society, we've had a lot to work. We've had our work cut out for us. On the questions of the right to life, on the protection of life, there's two aspects of that that were dealt a serious blow yesterday. One, of course, is passing positive legislation. You know, we all know that if the Supreme Court in today's oral arguments on the ban of partial birth abortion, which was passed through Congress repeatedly in the 90s, vetoed repeatedly by President Bill Clinton. Never could quite get the votes to override Bill Clinton's veto. When George Bush became president, he promised to sign a ban on partial birth abortion, and he kept that promise. And the Congress, under the leadership that it then had, passed that ban on partial birth abortion, and George Bush signed it, for which we thank them, and we are very grateful. Of course, it immediately was ensnared in the courts. And Planned Parenthood and others immediately ran into court and got it enjoined, and so it's taken years to try to get that cleared by the U.S. Supreme Court. Suppose this Supreme Court approves or gives a limited okay to this bill, but says you need to change one thing before we would let it go forward. Well, under the current leadership, it's very doubtful that we could pass that bill again, or that it would even come up again. Under the new leadership, so hostile would they be. The liberal leadership would be so hostile to defending the right to life, or even stopping this heinous, horrific abortion procedure of partial birth abortion. On the larger, on another question, of course, we had many judges came forward. Many judges were attacked by the then minority under Harry Reid. They were filibustered, unconstitutionally, many of us believe. They were filibustered to the point where, instead of what the Constitution says, that you have to have 50 votes plus one in the Senate to confirm a federal judge, these liberal activists and senators required 60 votes, effectively, to confirm a judge. Well, now, of course, the Judiciary Committee in the U.S. Senate will go into the hands of a very liberal, very, very liberal leadership, and President Bush must consider that when he nominates, if he gets another chance to nominate not only any federal judge, but especially a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. We, as you know, Senator Chuck Schumer, who was not only the leading advocate of abortion on the Judiciary Committee, but also the head of his party's recruitment of Senate candidates. He got them their funding, he got them their backing, and he is now enjoying the fruits of that success. You can well imagine that Senator Schumer will come out with a full-throated opposition to any judge, any prospective justice on the Supreme Court who does not completely genuflect to Roe versus Wade and the equally horrible Casey decision.
Let's talk about the gay marriage initiatives, the statewide gay marriage initiatives.
Yes.
What were the results yesterday among those statewide initiatives?
Seven of eight victories. That was the probably the lone bright spot in yesterday's dark cloud. That was a very, very encouraging to us. Again and again and again, when the American people are asked if marriage should be protected, if it should be a union recognized as a union of one man and one woman, the American people say yes.
Were all these initiatives of the nature of, say, a constitutional amendment, state constitutional amendments?
No, not all of them, but many of them are, and when they do that, that is very helpful. Of course, as you know, that doesn't necessarily protect. It's a good thing, it's a necessary thing, but we've had radicals on the judiciary who strike down even state constitutional provisions. They make extreme arguments. Some of them make extreme arguments in behalf of recognizing same-sex couples as marriages. We've been heartened. The one loss that we had, which, by the way, is the first loss we've ever had in any state, was in Arizona yesterday.
And what happened there?
Well, several things. One, the voters were confused by arguments that were raised by the other side, arguments that supposedly said that this would be used against cohabiting couples. We certainly can't approve of cohabiting couples, but this had nothing to do with cohabiting couples. We think that there may have been some seniors retiring to Arizona who, for reasons of Social Security, may have formed a cohabiting households. The other side put a huge amount of money into this, as they always do, and they concentrated on picking off one state. It's also the case in Arizona that the state Supreme Court said that there is no right to same-sex unions being recognized as marriages. That caused a lot of people to say, why are we doing this? Why is this necessary? If our own Supreme Court is saying that there is no right to same-sex unions being recognized as marriages, why do we have to amend our Constitution? So the answer to that, we think, is the better to recognize and to buttress marriage as an institution, so that if the Supreme Court membership changes, if it changes its mind, it will have one more a bulwark to overcome in any attempt to undermine marriage.
Bob Morrison is our guest. He's Director of Academic Affairs for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. We're talking about gay marriage and abortion initiatives and what role they played in yesterday's nationwide midterm elections. Let's talk about the South Dakota abortion ban for a while. What were its realistic prospects going into that statewide vote?
Well, as you know, that was an issue that was broadly debated even within pro-life circles. The real question was whether that was a good time and a good place to do it. I should say that that one of the things that we saw that is encouraging is that for the first time in 33 years, Americans had a chance to debate, to discuss, and to vote on the issue of abortion. We think that it is much more likely that human lives will be protected, more human lives will be protected through that kind of a process. As you know, the proponents of Roe v. Wade are horrified at the very thought of Americans ever having anything to say about that question. And as their own participation proves, they were able to succeed in even so conservative a state as South Dakota. We deeply regret the result. We strongly support the right to life. And it is very, very unfortunate that this result has occurred.
Well, my concern there, Bob, was that if this was ill-timed, and it had really to do with the makeup of the current U.S. Supreme Court, if this were ill-timed and were eventually sent up to the current U.S. Supreme Court, it might give that court an opportunity to knock down statewide bans and set a precedent there. That was my big concern about the South Dakota ban.
Well, you're right, but understand, striking down state laws is what the Roe majority does. Roe did that for 50 state laws. Most Americans don't realize that all 50 laws, even the very liberal laws, like my home state of New York, or the state that we once lived in, Washington State, those were very liberal laws. Well, even the liberal laws were struck down by Roe v. Wade. Roe overturned the state laws of 50 states. We have always regarded it as illegitimate. And I think one of the things, one of the takeaway lessons from South Dakota in 2006 is if, as the dust settles on this battle, is that people can say, look at this. 33 years after Roe v. Wade, it has still not been accepted by huge numbers of Americans. And so if it's regrettable that we only were able to get 44% of the vote yesterday, but that's still a tremendous vocal objection to the tyranny of Roe v. Wade. And so we take heart in that perspective. It may be that we can draft a better referendum. Your point is well taken. If that particular measure had carried and had been taken up by the current Supreme Court majority, that current majority could be expected to slap it down. But the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan used to say that one way that you correct an errant Supreme Court majority is to keep legislating against it. So I think to that extent, it's a good idea to present the Supreme Court with regular challenges to its illegitimate usurpation of authority. And it goes all the way back to Byron White, who I think his memorable dissent, here's a Kennedy appointee, a Protestant, a Rhodes Scholar. In no way is he an ideologue, and he called Roe an exercise in raw judicial power. You know, that ought to be on the epitaph of Roe v. Wade. It is that illegitimate.
I want your thoughts on Amendment 2, its slim passage here in Missouri. It made human cloning and destructive biomedical research using human embryos pretty much legislation and voter proof as a constitutional amendment here. Your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think what we saw is, nonstop steady propaganda put forth in its advocacy, the overwhelming amount of money that was brought to bear in Missouri. I mean, we have the deepest respect for Missouri as one of the great pro-life states in the country. I think we have thus far seen no treatments that have come from this source, and it is tragic that the real prospects for viable treatments from adult stem cell research, adult stem cells that do not constitute an ethical and moral dilemma. These are, in effect, discounted as people pursue this will-o'-the-wisp. In so many ways, you have to ask the question, even if it would be possible to bring about cures, which we don't yet have any example, even if that were the case, are we really prepared to do that? And I have to say, it's tragic when an amendment to a Constitution in effect does what Roe did. In effect, it prevents the people from Missouri and the legislators, the elected lawmakers of Missouri, from reconsidering this very, very unwise course of action.
I want to end with, and there's only 1 minute to respond here, Bob, just give us the big picture on gay marriage, if you would. How many states, as of today, have clearly spoken, not only the ones that spoke yesterday, but in the last election cycle as well, how many have clearly spoken in favor of protecting marriage? 1 minute.
27 states, by action of their own people, have overwhelmingly supported traditional marriage. And we are very, very grateful to all those citizens for doing that. It should also be added that a number of states, some of them surprisingly, like New York State, like Washington State, have their judiciaries have said there is no right to same-sex unions being recognized as marriages in our state constitution. Those are very liberal states. So what we have to see here is the effort to undermine marriage is not a liberal effort, it's a radical effort.
FRC.org, FRC.org is the website for the Family Research Council, and Bob Morrison is Director of Academic Affairs for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Thanks for being our guest and giving us these few minutes here, Bob.
It's my pleasure. It's wonderful to be with you.
All right, coming up here in another few minutes, Kristen Day, Executive Director of Democrats for Life, will be our guest. I want her reaction to one. Well, I want a reaction to the election, but I want her reaction to one race in particular, and that was Bob Casey very soundly defeating Rick Santorum, both these men pro-life in Pennsylvania. Bob Casey, a pro-life Democrat, and Rick Santorum, pro-life Republican. That'll come up here in just a few minutes. After we conclude our conversation with Kristen Day, Dr. Jeff Walls will be our guest. We'll be talking to him about the election, try and get the big picture as we go through some of the particulars with other guests. He's going to give us the big picture there and show us what may lie ahead as far as he can tell. We'll be talking with Congressman John Shimkus, pretty much skated to a victory yesterday in the 19th Congressional District of Illinois, but he was much in the news in the weeks leading up to the election. We'll get his thoughts on what happened yesterday with the American Electorate, and Dr. Sergio Trifkovic of Chronicles Magazine will be our guest at about 4:45. We'll talk about the impact. We know what the impact of the war in Iraq, or at least we suspect what the impact on the war in Iraq was on the election yesterday, but let's turn that around and ask this question. What was the impact of the election yesterday on the future of the war in Iraq? Sergio Trifkovic will be our guest there at 4:45. And then from 5 o'clock to the end of the program, those 45 minutes will be audio open lines for your questions and your comments. I want your reaction, starting in the third hour of the program, your reaction and your comments on yesterday's election. Big question in my mind is, did you vote? And then, if you did, I guess it was pretty good turnout in the bi-state area. If you did, how did you vote and why, and your reaction? Was it unexpected? Were you surprised? Were you disappointed? I think everybody's still trying to sort it out, whether they consider themselves part of the winners or the losers. There always are those in the elections. We're going to change up our schedule a little bit here and get with Kristen Day a little bit later in the program. Joining us to talk about the election in general, many of the votes are still being counted, you know. Dr. Jeff Walls, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He'll be with us here in the last few minutes of this segment and into the next. Dr. Walls, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be back.
What do you think was the issue, the major issue, of yesterday's vote?
Certainly the issue was the strong reactions by a number of voters to the Iraq war. We saw some exit polls that indicated that issue, and then also a bit surprisingly, but another issue that seemed to be on a lot of voters' minds was the idea of scandal and the number of scandals, both houses, both the Senate and the House, and also both parties had been a part of. And people really wanted a cleaner government, and for better or for worse, they saw the Democrats as the alternative.
Let's talk more about that on the other side of the break. Dr. Jeff Walls is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. We want to hear from you as well. This break is a good time to call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Would it surprise you to learn that the first several centuries of the Christian church were years plagued by controversy? There were arguments over the most basic of Christian teachings, the doctrine of the Trinity, the person of Christ, and the very nature of salvation in Jesus Christ. Does it surprise you that many Christians are completely unaware of this history? The old saying goes, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for November is called The Great Jesus Debates. You can find The Great Jesus Debates at our website, issuesetc.org. It's right there on the homepage, or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask them for the Issues Etc. book of the month for November, The Great Jesus Debates by Dr. Douglas Johnson, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040.
In 2006, an increasing number of states approved laws protecting pregnant women and their unborn children.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The case of Lacey Peterson drew national attention to the growing phenomenon of violence against pregnant women. News stories began appearing more frequently on television and in local newspapers of pregnant women whose boyfriends or husbands pushed them to have an abortion. After refusing, they became victims of violence that, in some cases, killed or injured their baby. Lawmakers have taken notice, and today, 34 states offer further legal protection for pregnant women and their unborn children.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. For more about our work to mobilize and advance pro-life women in politics, visit our website at sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I'm an early riser, so I was up this morning at 5:30 when I bumped into an old friend. "Morning," I mumbled, and then added, "Wow, what a night." "What do you mean?" my old friend asked. "Duh, the election. You voted, didn't you?" Well, my friend, I've known him for years and assumed I knew him well. My friend says, "Well, no." "What? You didn't vote? How come?" He says, "Hey, I've been around a long, long time. I've seen how it goes. Was the election important? Yeah, but it's not the biggest thing on my mind." This is turning into a challenging conversation for the early morning. "Well, then," I pushed back, "what is on your mind?" "Look," he says, "elections come, elections go. Parties come, parties go. Aren't people supposed to get up every morning and do what is right? Aren't they supposed to live by some higher standard than political gain? Hanging your hope or your disappointment on some election, isn't that shallow?" Got me thinking. Should I see yesterday's election in a different way? Maybe politics is not the beginning or the end of the world. Whoops, forgetful me. I forgot to tell you who was challenging me. It was God. Call it morning devotion. Life goes on. God is.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Obviously disappointed with the outcome of the election, and as the head of the Republican Party, I share a large part of the responsibility.
President George Bush earlier today in a White House press conference, his reaction to the elections yesterday. We'll see whether or not his general take there is borne out. Dr. Jeff Walls is our guest. He remains with us for about the next 20 minutes of Issues Etc. Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Dr. Walls, what do you make of the president's assessment there? What role did his unpopularity play? You mentioned the war and scandal before the break. What about the president's general unpopularity?
Yeah, his unpopularity around 58-60% certainly did not help him with especially independent voters. And that was kind of the interesting aspect of this election. We often hear in politics that it's important to get your base out to vote. So if you have hardcore Republican voters, it's important to get them out. If you have hardcore Democratic voters, the Democrats want to get them out. But the kind of interesting twist in this election was really the role that independents played, or those who made up their mind late in the campaign, even within the last 3 or 4 days. And those late-breaking voters and those independents leaned heavily in favor of the Democratic Party, in part because they did not like the Iraq war and the direction of that, as we mentioned, but also because they linked that directly to President Bush. And so for some voters, they saw the Iraq war and Bush really as indistinguishable.
I need to ask you, since the president also announced this afternoon that Donald Rumsfeld will be stepping down as Secretary of Defense.
Right.
Had he announced this and had Rumsfeld stepped down 2 months ago, 6 months ago, and they would have signaled a change of direction or something in the case of the war, do you think, I mean, it's speculation, but do you think it might have helped the Republican Party?
I think it might have helped, yeah. I think what some voters were looking for, and clearly what a number of Democrats were calling for, and even some Republicans, was a sense of a change of strategy or tactics, or some kind of indication that, you know, we've recognized this hasn't worked, or this hasn't worked as well as we'd like, let's go in a different direction. So, yeah, I think certainly doing something like this, as you say, 3, 4, 6 months ago, would have helped Bush and would have helped the Republicans a little bit, but I think more importantly than the personnel in that office or in any office is what kind of change might this augur for the policy or the on-the-ground tactics in Iraq. And that's what I think people, again, rightly or wrongly, were looking for, just a sense of let's try something different, let's try something new, and hopefully make the situation better.
As far as when we went on the air, there was still one Senate race that was technically undecided, the one out in Virginia. I don't think anything's happened there. They're doing a big recount in absentee voters, so we don't know. But let's just say for the sake of argument that that does go in the direction of the Democrats, giving them a very slim majority in the Senate. How big a shift has yesterday's election been? The obvious comparison is to 1994. And the Republican electoral victories there, is it as big a shift as it was in 1994?
Yeah, certainly, Todd. I think it's as big and potentially bigger, not in terms of numbers, but just in terms of the significance of what's changed since 94. One thing that some political scientists have looked at regarding elections is this penchant for incumbents of both parties, Republicans and Democrats, to draw their congressional districts to their advantage. So to try to put as many, likely incumbent voters into their district as possible. And so that's in part why we didn't see as much movement in the elections the last several times. And what some people were suggesting, and I actually thought the change in seats, what is it, 27 to 28 so far in the House, certainly exceeded some of my prognostications, simply because so many of these incumbents were drawn by legislatures, by governors, et cetera, into very safe districts. And sure, there were safe districts in 94, but certainly not as many of these safe districts. So even though the numbers may not compare quite to 1994 and the 50-plus change for the Republicans then, I think given the changing conditions, given all of the inherent advantages that incumbents have today, this is a very significant result, given some of those institutional challenges to the race challengers and even in the open seats.
How much do the Democrats need that West Virginia seat in the Senate? What difference will it make to them if they have a slim majority in the Senate, given the big shift that's taken place in the House?
Yeah, for the Virginia seat, I think it would be important for the Democrats. We saw several years back a 50-50 split in the Senate, and I think it worked well enough. You had collaboration and you had agreements in place as far as who would run committees, how many staff members would be on committees, and some kind of those logistical issues. But if in fact the Democrats do hold on, if Webb does hold on over Allen in Virginia, then this will be significant because that will allow potentially at least a House and a Senate Democratic leadership to shape legislation together. Now, that's, I guess, the upside for the Democrats. The challenge for the Democrats, though, is if you look at some of the seats in the Senate and the House that the Democrats won that were Republican, a number of these candidates might be called more moderate or even conservative Democrats. And you compare some of those with some of the more liberal Democrats, certainly Pelosi, I think, would be termed liberal. It's going to be difficult. She's the expected Speaker of the House. It's going to be difficult, I think, for the Democrats, even with this kind of a majority in the House and obviously in the Senate, if it's 51-49, to really cobble together legislation that they can get all members of their party to sign on to.
So it's one thing to, as many are crediting Pelosi with doing, it's one thing to orchestrate an election by putting key, more conservative Democrats in to beat incumbent Republicans. It's another thing to govern with those people after they've been elected.
Exactly, exactly. And I think what Pelosi does have going for her, in part, is a number of these candidates certainly owe her a little something. Now, certainly the candidates did much on their own, but Pelosi is seen as the head of the Democratic Party in the House, and I think rightly so, does deserve some credit for this victory by the Democrats.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc., and we're coming to you live this Wednesday, the 8th of November. Our call-in numbers 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're talking with Dr. Jeff Walls, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin, reflecting on yesterday's election and the fallout today. Let's talk with Eric, who calls from Sunset Hills. Hi, Eric.
Yes, hello. I have two areas of agreement with him and your political science professor and also with other pundits in that I think that the Republicans kind of were very weak, poor, or failed completely in their outreach to independents. But I think that that was not necessarily a big factor in some areas of the Southeast, also in the lower Midwest, particularly Missouri, and in most of the Western states. My own read on it is that we did, Republicans that is, and conservatives in particular, did particularly badly in several of the northeastern states, the northern mid-Atlantic and Michigan, and then lost a few critical House seats in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Arizona, and a few selected seats throughout the West. But basically in Missouri, all of our congressmen have held on to their seats. I think the Republicans still have a 6-3 advantage. Nationally, the Republicans have 48 or 49 senators. There are apparently two independents, and it's just a question of whether the Democrats will have 50 or 51.
And did you have a second point, Eric, or is both of those together there?
No, I have a second point
okay.
in that I think that Republicans have a heritage and an intellectual setup that comes out of the 19th century and the early 20th century, and it always looks to ahead, like, say, President Bush or key party leaders that have been around for 15 or 20 years, and they need to broaden out, be more modern in their management approach and in their marketing and in their just general ground operations,
okay.
and reach out more to middle-class voters, which they did very well in Missouri, with the exception of the middle-class people and people in general in the city of St. Louis, in the Clay County, the city of Kansas City, and a few select areas, a few select townships in North St. Louis County.
All right, Eric, thank you very much. He has two points. I'd like you to respond to both of them quickly. First of
sure.
all, did the Republicans do badly in the Northeast, Midwest, Southwest, and that's basically spelled their doom yesterday?
Yeah, in part it did. Some moderate to conservative Democrats held on in the East, for example, Chris Shays in Massachusetts. I'm sorry, in Connecticut. But yeah, when you look inside the numbers, and we haven't seen a complete analysis of this yet, you'll see that so many forces were arrayed against even the Republicans that you might think would do well in certain parts of the country, that made it a very, very uphill kind of battle. It's kind of struck looking at, for example, a more certainly very liberal, in some ways moderate, Republican, Lincoln Chafee in Rhode Island, kind of struck there apparently. And Chafee's a well-known name in Rhode Island. His father was a senator. Chafee had an approval rating there, the Republican, of over 60%, and yet White House still defeated him for that Senate seat. And there was just a sense in some parts of the country, some parts of the Atlantic, eastern parts of the country, Midwest, and Great Lakes State, that that we didn't want a Republican, that we simply wanted a Democrat to make a point about some sense of distrust or sense of anger at how things are going, for example, in Iraq. So that made it a very difficult uphill battle for a number of Republicans.
And then as to Eric's, he says the Republicans have an archaic management and marketing style. They need to update it to get in touch with kind of the middle America working class person. What do you say?
To a point, I still think the Republicans have a superior get-out-the-vote machine. Certainly, they tend to put more money into that than the Democrats. The Democrats on election day and 2 to 3 days before will tend to employ specific groups to get out the vote, such as labor groups and so on, whereas the Republicans still have a very impressive army of voters who make calls and otherwise kind of get the vote out for them at the grassroots level. So from a technological perspective, I think the Republicans have a pretty good operation. But again, in this election, it wasn't good enough just to mobilize their base.
This email comes from Kia in Birmingham, Alabama. She writes, I voted primarily Republican, although I'm very disappointed with the GOP, especially in matters of what she calls Christian pimping, the war's direction and hypocrisy. I could not vote for a party that is so outspoken about supporting immoral practices, examples, gay marriage and abortion. Your thoughts on those subjects?
Yeah, certainly interesting. This election, we didn't see nationally, at least, some of those somewhat divisive social issues referred to, gay marriage, abortion, play the role that certainly they have in past elections. We did see a lot of that activity, though, at the state level. For example, here in Wisconsin, we had a gay marriage amendment that did pass 60-40 to ban gay marriage. And also we had a death penalty referendum, non-binding, that would allow, and that did pass, that would allow the death penalty in certain cases. So, we saw pockets of that throughout the country. South Dakota voters, for example, rejected a certain proposal on abortions, on a fairly comprehensive ban on abortions. So, no, I think that's a very good point. Again, what we may see now from the Democratic Party, we haven't heard a lot of discussion about those social issues in this first 100 hours that Speaker to be Pelosi has promised. So certainly I could see a leftward tilting on those issues, but I think the party will focus first, Democratic Party, on Iraq, maybe even on immigration, on lobby reform, things like that.
Two final questions for you. The president and in his press conference earlier today sounded a note, I think, of what could be called guarded optimism about working with a Republican-led House and perhaps a Democrat-led House and perhaps Democrat-led Senate. How lame of a duck is the president for the next 2 years if that is, in fact, the majorities he's going to have to deal with?
Well, I'd actually hold out a little hope here. The one theory of thought here is that it'll be complete gridlock and nothing will get done, and certainly that's possible on some issues. But I also look at an issue like immigration, where I think with this new composition of the House and Senate being more in tune with Bush on immigration, Bush wanting a more comprehensive immigration plan, and the Democrats overall wanting the same thing. So there, I think, is possibility of something happening there. We go back to Clinton, for example, in 1996, working with the Republican Congress on welfare. Go back to Reagan, 1986, working with Democrats, Reagan the Republican, on a tax code reform. So, certainly it could be a sense of nothing getting done and a very lame duck president. On the other hand, I think if the president and the Democratic leaders can find those issues where they can come together, I think we could see some movement on at least a few issues.
And then with only 1 minute, Dr. Walls, on both sides, Republican and Democrat, in light of yesterday's election results, which candidates from both parties will emerge as strong candidates for president in 08?
That's a good question. I think this in a way strengthens John McCain's hand. McCain, the senator from Arizona, who also ran in 2000, just from the perspective that if we do have a lot of gridlock, and if the Democrats can't get things done, then I think the nation may be looking for a strong Republican leader to perhaps, move the Iraq issue forward. As far as Hillary Clinton on the other side, certainly she's a leading candidate for the Democrats. This could work several different ways, but actually I think she was more viable with a Republican House and Senate, simply because she would then be a Democratic alternative. I think it might be harder for her to run now, among other reasons, with a Democratic Congress, but we'll see.
It will be hard for her to run, given the fact that she basically won in the landslide in New York, and before the election said she plans on being senator for 6 years.
Right. She did. Right. She did pledge to fulfill her entire term, and we'll see. We'll see if that happens.
Dr. Jeff Walls is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Dr. Walls, it's always a pleasure, and thank you very much for being our guest on
Issues Etc. All right, thank you, Todd. Have a good day.
Well, joining us for the remainder of this hour is Kristen Day, a regular guest and Executive Director of Democrats for Life. We're going to be talking to her about pro-life Democrats and yesterday's election. Kristen, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back.
I need to hear your reaction on Bob Casey's decisive victory over Rick Santorum. Both of them pro-life candidates, one Bob Casey, a Democrat, the other Rick Santorum, a Republican in Pennsylvania.
Oh, we're just thrilled that Bob Casey won, because I think it sends such a positive message that it's okay to be pro-life and Democrat, and the party will get behind you. So I think it was a very exciting win for us.
How did pro-life Democrats fare in general as you see the landscape in yesterday's election?
Very well. We have six new pro-life Democrats coming to Congress, and most of them defeated Republican incumbents. So pro-life Democrats played a role in reclaiming the House.
Can you pinpoint them on the map? Who are we talking about, and where are they from?
Sure. We're talking about Charlie Wilson from Ohio. That was an open seat. Heath Shuler from North Carolina. Two Indiana new congressmen-elect, Joe Donnelly and Brad Ellsworth. And we have two Pennsylvania ones, Jason Altmaier and Chris Carney. So it was a very exciting night for us.
Do you think, in fact, I just read today a headline that Howard Dean says that Bob Casey is going to be invited to speak at the Democratic National Convention as we go into a presidential election in the next couple of years. Do you think the Democratic Party is beginning to see the value of pro-life Democrats as voters and as candidates?
Oh, I absolutely do. And I was looking at the press release we issued 2 years ago, and it was disappointment and we were encouraging the Democratic Party to realize that pro-life Democrats are an integral part of our party and should be supported. And what a difference 2 years makes. Pro-life Democrats were on the red to blue list, and we're receiving the full support of the party, and look what happens.
Then let's talk about pro-choice Democrats. As you look out there, I'm just thinking here about the Missouri race that concluded last night, where Jim Talent, a pro-life Republican, is defeated by, I think it's safe to say, Claire McCaskill is a pro-choice Democrat. How much of that was going on yesterday?
Pardon me?
How much of that was going on yesterday?
There was some of that, too. I think there was obviously a big anti-Bush, anti-war sentiment going on around the country, and a lot of Republicans, too, wanted new leadership for the country and didn't like the way things were going and the way that Republicans were handling things. So there was a lot of that going on, too. But, we're just really proud of our pro-life candidates who stood up and ran on their records.
What are your thoughts on the leadership, the new Democratic leadership in the House and perhaps in the Senate? I think it's safe to say that the leadership is not pro-life. How hard is it going to be for guys like Bob Casey to rise in the ranks of leadership?
I think, over in the Senate, we have Harry Reid, who I think it will be a little bit easier for him to having, two pro-life Democrats in the Senate instead of just one. So I think the company there of having two pro-life Democrats in the Senate is going to be good. As far as the House, the only sure thing we know in the House is Nancy Pelosi is probably going to be the Speaker. And she has already said that she's going to govern from the middle. And, I'll take her at her word on that. And, we look forward to talking to her about, our proposal to decrease the abortion rate, the Pregnant Woman Support Act. And hopefully that will be on the top of the agenda for next year.
Now, you're probably fully aware of the fact that the take on Nancy Pelosi's orchestration of a Democrat victory has been, well, what she's done is use pro-life Democrats to get a victory and a majority, but she's not going to let them in when it comes to actually governing for the next 2 years at least.
I don't think that that's going to be allowed to happen. I think when you have the blue dogs, and you also have a lot of the new members coming on in our moderate, you know, we have 35 pro-life Democrats in the House, and I think their voices are going to want to be heard. And, you know, especially when you compare 2004 to 2006, and if we want to, you know, keep building, I think we're going to, you know, I'm pretty confident that she is going to listen.
What about the voters? We've talked about the candidates. What about pro-life Democrat voters, people who will vote for a Democratic candidate if they are pro-life? If they're not, then they often will switch sides. Did we see them more vocally present yesterday?
I think now, I mean, compare, you know, 2004 to 2006, I think, you know, pro-life Democrats are feeling more comfortable that our party is shifting and that, you know, we're not the party of abortion on demand anymore, and we are the big tent, and our voices are going to be heard. So I think that the pro-life Democrats are feeling more comfortable. And when you look at people like Barron Hill, who won yesterday, also in Indiana, and he has a pro-life voting record that, you know, he has some votes that weren't pro-life, but I think his record is going to be a lot stronger now that he comes back, because I think the leadership has freed people up to really vote their conscience and not listen to the agenda of NARAL and Planned Parenthood anymore.
Two quick final questions. Do you expect a change, if any, in the platform of the Democratic Party on the issue of life?
Oh, absolutely. I am looking forward to the 2008 platform. It's going to be so refreshing to have our point of view represented in the platform.
And you think it will be?
I really do, because, I mean, especially with Bob Casey's win and Howard Dean already saying that he's going to speak in 2008. I think there's no turning back at this point. You know, we are the big tent. We do include pro-life people in the party, and the 2008 platform is going to look much better.
Then finally, make the case for us, Kristen, that being pro-life is consistent with the philosophy of the Democratic Party.
I think when you look at, I mean, obviously the abortion issue, the platform is not pro-life, but I think when you look at the death penalty, when you look at feeding the hungry, when you look at, you know, when you look at war, when you look at other life issues, the Democratic Party definitely has a strong pro-life agenda when you're looking at the Consistent Life Network. And I think that the last one that we need to really move on is the abortion issue. And once we do that, we are going to be a Consistent Life party.
Do you think we'll hear voices from the Democratic Party if the U.S. Supreme Court manages to uphold a ban on partial birth abortion? Do you think we'll hear some hoorays from the Democratic Party vocally enough?
I think because when we passed the Partial Birth Abortion Act, you know, there were close to 80 Democrats supporting it. So I think most of the country does think, you know, the partial birth abortions should be illegal. And so I think we will. I think we're going to hear a much more vocal pro-life Democrat contingent from now on.
DemocratsForLife.org is the website address for Democrats for Life. It's all one word, followed by .org, Democrats for Life. And Kristen Day is Executive Director of Democrats for Life. Thank you very much for giving us your time, Kristen. I know you're busy.
Thank you so much. And I just think one thing we should do as pro-life people is that we really should think about working with Democrats, because a lot of times pro-life people won't work with Democrats because they think it's the party of abortion on demand. But now's the time that we really need to work together if we're gonna solve this problem. And we have to get over party labels and work with the pro-life community, no matter what party you're in.
Thank you, Kristen. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for November harkens back to some ancient history, but some very important history. It's called The Great Jesus Debates, Four Early Church Battles About the Person and Work of Jesus. The book is $19.99 plus shipping and handling. You can find out more about it by just going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask them about The Great Jesus Debates. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. We'll come back to talk with, we'll talk about Johann von Staupitz after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Bishop Walter Obari of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kenya on the work of LCMS World Relief.
LCMS World Relief has come to our church as a real relief organization and has really supported a lot of projects in our church. An example is relief to our pastors by giving a cow to every pastor, which has been done to all pastors now, and LCMS World Relief has come in to support. Our deaconesses are working with women. It is true that God really sent LCMS World Relief to come to our aid at a real critical time, at a real time of need. The presence of LCMS in our church has been felt almost in every corner of the church by what has been taking place.
To support the work of LCMS World Relief, call them toll-free 888-930-4438.